And now, an ad from Dad.
All right. Save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive. Can I take these off?
All right. What is this? This looks good.
Wow. That's well made. Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, my name is Daryl Ong, and you're tuned into the show that brings you closer to the people and places of our capital city. It's July, smack in the middle of the year, and this week we're going to revisit some of our favourite stories that have graced our humble show. Coming up, the story of a Rohingyan football club based right here in KL with big aspirations.
So you play with us, we're part of Burma, not only from yesterday, we are from many decades we've been, you know, together, but because there's some political interests and some geographical, some resources interests, so these things collide, and then we are fighting with each other.
And then a renowned Malaysian zoologist who has several animals named after him.
I kept a pet musang, you know.
You had a pet musang?
Yeah. A pet musang, forest musang, big fellow. Wow. You know? I keep it in the lab, no?
Up first, the story of Rohingya FC. Football is a universal language, and that's the underlying idea behind Rohingya FC, a small football club with big aspirations, comprised of Rohingyan refugees living in Kuala Lumpur. The club consider themselves as the Rohingyan national team and hope to someday play in the World Cup, with an aim to give these young men a productive and purposeful way to spend their free time and to help them better integrate with the local community. Earlier in the year, we spoke to the club chairman, Mr. Noh, as he sheds light on the problems the marginalised community faces and how sport can help overcome those problems.
As a Rohingya and as an activist, I'm involved in many of the Rohingya development community building projects. One of the projects is RFC, Rohingya Football Club, which is built in 2015 with an aim how to create a national Rohingya football team that can go to some sort of World Cup or national state level games and all this, to enhance the image of the Rohingya and to build the community itself. Because Rohingya has been misrepresented as not only poor people, as taking up resources of other countries as well. Okay. So that's why the RFC has been formed, and then we have been working so hard.
Why football specifically?
Why football? Because football being a very widely watched across the world, number one. And number two is within the community, we don't have anything to be together with. So football is something very commonly used, not only within the Rohingya, but international, which is acceptable and not something politics. There is no involvement of any sort of interest. It's just a pure game entertainment. That brings the spirit, most importantly.
And it's a universal language.
It's a universal language, sending the message to other persecuted communities like Palestinians and Syrians and Iraqians.
I mean, the Rohingyan community is really oppressed to the point where even in KL, they're almost like invisible within plain sight, right? And football gives that form of escapism to the community, doesn't it? It takes you away from the troubles and you know, the struggles that you have to go through.
Yes, one of the most important thing here, especially in Malaysia, is that you know, being a Rohingya community here, of course they are illegal, first of all, but some of them have UN registration card, which is also doesn't consider as a full legal document as well. It's just a temporary shelter. It's a mutual understanding between the United Nations High Commission of Refugees and the local authorities collaborating to sympathize with these poor people. But you know, because being a huge, large community here, we are talking about 150,000 people, which, you know, their jobs are not taken care, their health care is not taken care, their education is not taken care. So when we talk about football, there's a lot of people are, you know, show their interest towards the Rohingya community, where they come and see some Rohingya fresh talents. And then we have a lot of friendly matches with the local people, which is also part of the assimilation, part of the harmony together. So once we become friends, then they started to talk like, oh, okay, so can you tell me your problem? So communication, you know, goes on. So this poor nation, this poor people might get help along the way. So we are like thinking, how can we, you know, convince the local community and then, you know, do their responsibility.
Can you tell us a bit about how you start the club? As in, is it difficult to get resources? How do you gather the players? How do you gather coaches to train the players?
I mean, it's like, you know, picking up rocks from the water to build a house. It's like that. First of all, the people itself, the Rohingya itself, they are scattered all over Malaysia, which is somewhere in Kuantan, Kelantan, Terengganu, Penang, and all this. So to put them together, there's a legal issue of the transportation. There are many other things as well. So that is one. Secondly, those who Rohingyas are also here in Malaysia, they are all mostly workers. You know, they do plumbing, grass cutting, electrical wiring and all this. So we cannot hire them full time. So they do their own work and then, you know, join us later when they are free. So as a volunteer, something like that.
When you say hire full time, you mean being full time with the team?
Full time with the team, practice all the time and all this. So these, they are just, you know, workers from every corner of life. And then they just want to have their passion, have their talent.
So they're like part-time footballers, you mean?
Part-time footballers. So that is the second. You know, the third one is every time you play a football, you have some expenses. You need to, even within the KL, within the Klang Valley, some lives in Selayang, some live in Ampang, so you need to get them some transportation allowances to come to a place. And then the football field itself, you know, costs money, sometimes 200 ringgit. And then, you know, you need to have some beverages for each game we play. We are talking about 400 to 500 ringgit. And then the referee itself, sometimes we try to be more professional, get Malaysian referees as well to be very fair so that people will not, something like that. So... So each game need a lot of coordination, need a lot of compromises. This player say, I cannot make it this week. The other player say, I cannot make it that week because we are not, you know, full time. So we have to, like, you know, accommodate everybody's
timing
and coaching. Right. Yeah.
It's the local footballing community and the local footballing league. Are they helping you guys contribute and in that sense and taking in you guys to the league or anything like that?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I mean, for the last 2 years, we have seen a tremendous support, especially help from the local community. Just to name a few, we have played with Astro Awani and Tenaga National and then Utusan Malaysia as well. And then we played one called DD Social League as well. And then it is not that, you know, they help us or sympathize us. They really play as a player, and we also play. And most of the game, you will not believe it, most of it we won.
Nice.
Yeah. So because our people have a lot of burning desire, we always tell them, look, this is here to show the talent. So we have to show, and we have to play by the rules, you know. Don't hurt anybody, don't push anybody. We are here to do a friendly match. We're not going to convert this into a war.
Right.
So we play mutually and get it done. And then we saw quite a number of support, but in not a very greater level. Means to say individual with a few players, but we are like hoping and wishing to get more coverage, more people involved, more teams involved, more like a state level, you know, the Selangor level and Terengganu. Yes,
Definitely. All
those things, yeah.
You mentioned that, you know, RFC is not just to play football, but also to take advantage of the positive impacts of sport. Can you just give us some examples of the
RFC, the concept of RFC or the foundation of RFC was built not only to play, because Rohingya itself is a minority, persecuted minority, and considered the most persecuted minority on earth.
Yep.
So we have more than one responsibility. So number one is how to build this community. And number two, we have like a lot of growing youngsters who we believe or we think that they might divert into crimes, into other unnecessary activities that goes into the local authorities' hand. We are already illegal as a Rohingya here. And Malaysian government is really, you know, sympathizing us. We do not want to lose that sympathy, getting into trouble, getting into problems. So in other hand, we are also controlling our youngsters, as I said. This is our host country. They are helping us to stay here, so we have to obey their law. We have to fulfill this. So how do we do that? We do it through the games. We coordinate. So they have less time to do all
right.
The unnecessary things.
Okay.
Because everyone wants to be sense of belonging. So we belong to RFC. Everywhere they go, they get applauds. They get, you know, supported. So he himself shies to do anything bad. If I do anything, I will be misrepresented.
Right, because I'm a hero in this community.
I'm a hero
right?
in
I'm
the
a
community.
Top scorer.
I'm a top scorer, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So doing anything bad, it will affect my image. So you know, things bound together, you know, not to do bad things.
How has the reception been like for the community, especially youngsters? Are they receptive towards the program?
Oh, yes, yes, tremendously. I mean, if you look at the support, if you look at the videos that we play on our vision as well, we get 30,000, 40,000 hits on that RFC video, and there's a lot of inquiries comes from all across the world, because Rohingya lives in Bangladesh, in India, in Pakistan, and then you have in Sri Lanka, in Indonesia, in Thailand, right? So they call us, how can we join together, you know, to play this, and then what can we support? So there's a lot of support, because this is purely youngsters. Not only support from the youngsters, also from their parents. Parents also encourage, you know, there's like an example now in Malaysia, say, you know, if you become very good, we will introduce you to Mr. Chairman Muhammad Noor, so he will put you into the RFC, so you'll become famous.
Right.
So you have to work hard, you have to study hard, so it's setting a benchmark there.
I noticed that you mentioned in a couple while doing research for you that you want RSC to play with the Myanmar national team.
Right? Yes, yes, of course.
Do you think that football would be a key factor in national reconciliation?
It could be one if they want to make it. Because, you see, there's too much of parties involved now in the Rohingya case. The Rakhine itself, which is the MOG, and then the extremist group, the Burmese group, international pressure, international governments, and so a political approach has been in place,
okay,
you know, to get the reconciliation done. I mean, I believe that, you know, not everyone in the country is, you know, awful or evil. So there are good-hearted people in Burma. So we send the message to the good heart. Say, you play with us. We are a part of Burma. Not only from yesterday, we are from many decades we've been, you know, together, but because there's some political interests and some geographical, some resources interests, so these things collapse. And then we are fighting with each other. The big rich men and the armies are keep going to the bank, and then we poor people are fighting. So we want to send a positive message with something, which is, so RFC could be one platform. And not only that, we have achieved a target as well. So we send a message to the Myanmar government or the Myanmar national team to play with us. Actually, there are some other local teams, like other races, other ethnic races. Recently, we played with some of the Kaching people who are Christians. So they live in Malaysia, is it? Come, let's play. So we want to play with all other ethnic minorities to bring the reconciliation. We already actually got a score already. So they came with us, so we played, we sat down together, then we had some chit-chat, we, you know, shared our sorrows and happy moments and all this. So something is going forward. So one day we hope that the Myanmar national team really think about this and then play with us.
How has the journey been like for Rohingya FC, especially financially? Do you get a lot of sponsors, or how do you generate funds?
At this moment, it's all self-sponsored by me, by a couple of others, Rohingya merchants or entrepreneurs, because we are running on the very low and tight budget as well. As I told you, like each game we play at least requires about 500 ringgit in Malaysia, just some basic beverages and referee fees and the field, stuff like that. So it's all self-funded. We have not got any fund yet so far, but there is a few parties who are interested. So one of them is like a kick project as well. Maybe we can talk into detail. So they would like to sponsor us and all this. So Australian government itself is very much helpful. They have actually pledged us with our own jersey, which is supported by the Australian government. So it is a very positive. So we also hope that the Malaysian government or Malaysian NGOs also use this platform to put the Rohingya, you know, in order in terms of other things, so that there is a body, management, a facility. So it's a message to other local NGOs and the government bodies and all this, you know, to help us and put ourselves. Because if government comes on board, it might not help. Like if they allow us to play in any of the football field, so football field fee we don't have to pay anymore. So there's one huge burden is going off. At this moment, we don't have any dedicated field. Sometime we're here, sometime we're there. So there's a lot of room, you know, for many parties can help RFC.
RFC has been going on for 2 years now, still going strong. Tell us a bit about your training sessions. How many players do you get regularly, and also how does it help the community?
Okay, first of all, the player of RFC, we talk about how we choose the players first.
Okay.
Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of Rohingya village teams. Arakan is a state of Burma. In Arakan, we have about 1,000 plus villages in Arakan itself. So if we don't have 1,000 teams, but we have in Malaysia at least, you know, 20 to 30 teams, not organized, not well funded and all this stuff like that. So we chose players from those area, from those teams to become a national team. That's how only we can get. So we go here and then we pick up a few players. We go there and then we pick up a few players. So that's how we put the team together. So that is one. Secondly, now for the team itself, we do practice on, we try to practice at least twice a month, you know, every alternative weeks. But it's not really helping because we need more practice and more. We are hoping that if some supporters comes in, maybe we can do it regularly, every week once and all this, and then a longer session. So that's the plan at this moment we are going on. Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about the age range for your players?
Age range is a start from 19 all the way go up to 30. Sometimes it depends on, because there's a lot of people want to play. So we only chose the best, first of all. And second, we still, everybody is in the team. We currently, we have about 21 players. But we also have at the side at least 30 players, which a lot of people want to play. And then we have about 20 people in the management. So everybody comes, we try to include them, either in the management body, in the side players, either so that nobody is excluded. Because a room is small and everybody want to get in. Right. So,
so you gotta pack as many bodies in as you can. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yes.
Is there any attempt to maybe integrate with the local community here through football?
At this moment, there is none, but intention is there. Intention means to say, how can we integrate with the local community? There's a lot of areas, you know, the college football games and the school football games. And then we would like to also do some junior football club, which is below 15, where a lot of youngsters will study in some unorganized schools and centers and tuition centers, because Rohingya is not getting any formal education, you know, school pipeline and all this. So, and then play with some juniors so that we have some, you know, local community Malaysians and children and the Rohingya children play together. So they become friends. So there is a possibility of integration as well.
How about the women?
In terms of women, we have actually started women's sport as well, okay, because football is not widely practiced in women, especially the Rohingya community, because of the cultural barrier and stuff like that. But we are doing some running competition for the last 3 months. Rohingya Women Development Organization is a social welfare organization where we collaborate together to bring this type of events. And we are also thinking to do self-defense classes for the women as well.
Do you have any personal relationship with any of the players? Maybe you can share some of their stories with
us. I mean, we are all friends, number one. And then personal means to say they're all like brothers to me. Each of them, like I tell you, one who came from a Bangladesh refugee camp. We are talking about one room which is by 2 meter by 2 meter, and it's not by wall, it's by bamboos or some wood. This is where they live, this is where they cook, this is where they sleep, and this is where they go toilet as well. It's worst condition ever you can imagine. So they have brought up there. Father or a mother or a family cannot afford 2 pencils for the entire year. So these type of kids, when they come here, they have been embraced. So these are the children, when they walk, nobody look at them. Nobody actually pay attention to them. Nobody listen to them. They are treated as a dirt. So today, in a community country like Malaysia, they can come and play football. Malaysian communities applaud them. They have get to meet with, mashallah, many times with Khairi Jamaluddin, which is the sport minister. So this is a great achievement and a great empowerment for them. So something they could have never imagined.
That was Mr. Noh, the RFC club chairman, a Rohingyan football club based right here in KL. Coming up, we revisit another one of our favourite stories this year.
I kept a pet musang, you know.
You had a pet musang?
Yeah. A pet musang, forest musang, big fellow. Wow. You know? I keep it in the lab, you know.
Stay tuned, my name's Daryl, and this is I Love KL, BFM 89.9.
Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.
BFM 89.9, my name's Daryl Ong, and you're tuned into the show that brings you closer to the people and places of our capital city. Our second story for our mid-year roundup takes us to the world of animals. Our guest is a renowned zoologist and one of the pioneers of zoology in Malaysia, since 1953, Dr. Lim Bu Liat published over 302 scientific papers, recognized with numerous awards for his contribution to biodiversity through scientific studies. 91 years of age now, he dedicated his entire professional career working on animals in connection with zoonotic diseases, so much so that some of these animals were named after him. Here's Dr. Lim Bu Liat telling us his story.
My father was a very poor man, miserably poor, and unable to send me to schools and so forth. But I was able to get into the school up to Form 4. At that time, it's known as Junior Cambridge, but it's only 1942, you know. Mm. And the Japanese war came, then that's all out. Then after that, you know, my father passed away and so forth. Then I was the sole bread earners for a family of eight, you know.
So, and I read somewhere you did, you know, really odd jobs like selling vegetables and...
I do all kinds of things, you know, that. And when you are in that kind of positions where you have to earn money and support a family of eight people, you do anything under the world. Anything that you can do, anything that you can make a bit of money, you know, to support the family. I was a rickshaw puller, so all kinds of things you can think of, I've gone through.
No, okay. Yeah. So from all this, you know, you have not a lot of time on your hands back then. So how did, you know, this interest in zoology and, you know, how did your love for animals start?
Yes, it's interesting how I started the zoology. You know, in the old days, when you are in the school, in the English schools, they started these nature studies.
Yeah.
And nature studies in the old days, I'm talking about 1933. In the old days, all English schools, they have some nature studies. And nature studies are taught, you know, partly in the class and partly in the field. In the schools, they have this nursery, which is very big, at least about 2 acres, you know, that, where there's somebody is taking care of the nursery, pots of plants and so forth to just beautify the surrounding of the schools. Mm. When a nature study comes in, some of us has to go down to that place and learn practical. And we learn how to collect butterflies and all this sort of thing. You know, and sometimes, you know, the person who's in charge there come across a snake and say that, well, this is a snake. And that's how I got interested in natural history.
But I mean, a lot of people fall in love with animals, not for the same reasons you do, though. You wanted to get to the scientific aspect of animals, right?
And that was because, in 1947, I went to KL, and a friend of mine in the Institute for Medical Research, known as IMR, in Pahang Road. And there, they said there's a vacancy for a lab technologist. Now, at the time, we call it lab assistants. You know? They said, why not you try to apply? So I applied. And to be honest, even in the old days, to become a lab assistant is not that easy. You know? And I was told by my predecessors, they have to have a senior Cambridge. In the old days, the senior Cambridge is all the examinations papers are from the Cambridge University in London, which is now Form 5. You know? For me, I do not have a senior Cambridge, neither do I have a junior Cambridge certificate because of the war. You know? The reason why I was put in is primarily because, A, there are lack of people who are prepared to apply. B, you know, there was a division known as the Scrub Typhus Division, which was supported by the Colonial Development Fund in London, not Malaysian Fund. You know, they came here to do a certain type of research known as Scrub Typhus Research. They need an assistant, and at the same time, they also pay you 1.5 times salary. I need that, didn't I? When we started, as a technician, as a laboratory assistant, you start with $80. Those old days, $80, $47, a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I say I need more money, you know. Then say, well, there's temporary organizations, divisions, you know. They may pay you 1.5 times. So I went off on a temporary for 1.5 times. I work as a lab assistant, but one of the most important thing at that time, in 1947, the country is known as the British Administration, BMA, British Administration Organizations, you know. And most of the officers are still British, all Europeans, normally from England. Then we had, in this particular division that I work with in the Institute for Medical Research, IMR, I work with a couple of very, very excellent officers. One is Professor J.L. Harrison, the late Professor Harrison, the late Professor J.R. Odie, and we were employed there in that particular divisions. Now, in old days, though I do not have that kind of qualification, but I have already, you know, in my younger days in the school, I already had certain knowledge about natural history. Another very important point that how I was able to be accepted by them is, A, during the Japanese time, I started manufacturing soap. Not only I manufactured soap, but I also salt.
Salt.
Salt, okay. You know. And to get salt, you just go to the Straits of Malacca water, which is very saltish, boil it in 8 hours, you turn it into salt, you know. And then the ash, you know, has a certain amount of soda content. You boil the ash, and then once it turns into water, you sieve the water, and then that is solidic type of water. Then if you want to make soap, you know what you do is so you boil the water, you know, then you add coconut oil, and then you get a crystallizations, and then you add salt to totally crystallize it.
Wow, I mean, you really have a wealth of experience and a wealth of knowledge.
Now, there, I was very lucky in the sense when I got the Orang Asli in Kerry Island. My soap factory was in Kerry Island, got the Orang Asli to help me to do the work. Mm. Which, you know, I gave them a very fair deal. Every one of them got a share.
That's great. Yes. I mean, you work with young people now.
I work with very young people.
So do you feel that, you know, you're just telling me of your childhood, you're doing all this making soap, making salt.
Yeah.
Do you feel that young people now in this age of, you know, technology, smartphones and all of that, can they learn the same kind of values and experience?
No, I don't think so now, you know, because those are hard type of work. You know, you have to go and get your boot, you know, to get the ash. Now, you got to have mangrove woods. The mangrove woods are very solid and so forth, and they have a certain amount of soda content,
okay.
You know, which I know nothing about chemistry because from tree, how do you know about chemistry? You know, nothing of the sort.
But sometimes the best way to learn is to just do it.
Yeah, just do it. That's right, you know.
So you have published about 302 scientific papers. Mm-hmm. You even have a frog species among many other different animals named after you.
Yes, yes.
I mean, how does it feel? It's not every day you meet someone with animals named after them, right?
It's quite true, you know that. Now, people are very nice. A lot of people are working with me and so forth. And when they find a new species, you know, these are very, very serious scientists. And most of these people who name an animal after me, excellent scientists, dedicated scientists.
Okay, so wait, you didn't name them. They named them after you.
They named it after me, yes.
Did you remember the first one?
Oh, my first one was a black parasite. That was a name after a flying lemur. I was interested in all the small mammal. I did the small mammal. I do everything. And I pass whatever informations, you know, whatever parasite information to the specialist. And I had my own specializations. Within my field, I work on it. And those are a lot of materials, you know. We just pass it down to those other people that do it. So it so happened I passed it to Professor A. Sandosum. Professor A. Sandosum, when he was young, he was the dean of the medical faculty in Singapore. And when he retired from there, he came to the Institute for Medical Research and worked on malaria. And he's one of the foremost malaria in this country. So he found these parasites, you know, and he named after me.
Do you remember the name?
I forgot.
Yes, too many. There's too many.
Yes.
What did you specifically specialize in?
My natural mentors are the Orang Asli. When I was having a soap factory during the Japanese regime, sometimes I stay with them in the kampongs, and from there I learn about rats, squirrels, snakes, and so forth. They were my natural mentor.
They were zoologists even before there was...
They were beautiful. Yeah. You see, I think what not many people really realize that Orang Asli, the old days, the Orang Asli, I call them nature naturalists.
Oh, that's brilliant.
No?
Yeah.
They know everything. Now, you talk of pharmaceutical things, traditional medicines, you know, and so forth. A lot of scientists are excellent. When you go into this field, I mean, I'm not saying that they are not good, but they are very good. But they need someone to help them. If they go to the forest when they are young and so forth, they go to the forest, you know, and say that this is a medicinal plant and so forth. The orang asli are the one that knows. Now, go back to the animal point of view. Dogs, cats. Now, when your dog's sick, you let him out. He knows where to go and get his type of plants to eat. It's natural.
Natural.
Yes, natural. So the orang asli too, you know. Now, old Chinese also are very, very good. What type of plants is good for? What kind of sickness and so forth?
Sometimes it just comes with your livelihood.
Yes, livelihood is right.
So let's talk specifically about one of your past projects now. You actually studied and experimented on 20,000 rats, all kinds of rats, wild rats, rats, etc.
You see, in the Institute of American Research, we don't kill a rat for killing sake. Now, when we trap rats, you know, Institute of American Research is a field research station during the British time. And what happened was, we as lab assistant, I worked with very famous people like Professor Odie and Jerry Harrison, which I told you, you know, these are top-notch people in the world, you know. They would make me as a lab assistant work under them. And I was put under the vertebrate section.
Okay.
Then there's an invertebrate section that works on what are insects and so forth, which is under another person. But I concentrated on the vertebrate section. So we do a lot of research work on the rats. Now we go to the field, we trap the rats, we mark the rats, we release the rats and make records of every single animal that we caught and release. Now this will give us a lot of information. Because a project of that nature will take at least about 3 years to do it.
Okay.
You know? And during that part of 3 years, when you get into the collect the data and so forth, you find that, you know, a lot of rats were retrapped. So the density, sometimes, people, you know, go around and say, well, you know, we put some trap, we got so many rats, the density is not high. It must be very high, you know. It can be the otherwise. So from there, while marking, we got back the rats, and it took 3 years to do a piece of project of that nature. Then we will be able to know their home range, where they go about. Then the number of animals that caught against the number of retrapped will give you some idea of the populations.
Wow. So you can actually get a sizable number of data.
Oh, yes, yes. The recapture is quite high sometimes. And very interestingly, you know, I always say that, of course, a lot of the scientists would not agree with me, you know. But it's good that they should not agree with me.
Could have two sides, right?
Yeah, yeah. Because you can train a rat. Say that you have a plot of land, say, about a hectare, and you have ponds. And you can train certain species of rats, you know, will go round and round and round. And when you plot them out, they'll be, you know, within a hectare's area, you know. And then you are not careful, then you say, oh, this animal is within a hectare's area, which is not true.
So there's a lot of little details.
Yes. No, you were just now asking me, I publish a lot of papers.
Yeah.
Now, publishing papers, you know, that when I first published my paper, you know, my paper was being my boss, Jerry Harrison, you know, he taught me how to write because I got only standard 7 educations, you know. And let's be very honest, I couldn't even speak good English. I couldn't even write good English. Then it was these orang putih people taught me how to write, teach me how to write, teach me how to measure things, teach me how to do mathematics, you know, and this sort of thing. And when I write my first paper, it was through the encouragement I wrote my first paper was on the musang.
Musang.
I kept my pet musang, you know.
You had a pet musang.
Yeah. The pet was a forest musang, big fellow, you know, and keep it in the lab, you know. And because Harrison is interested in studying the behavior of the musang, I kept a lot of animals. I kept all kinds of animals in my lab, you know. And Harrison is interested in studying the behavior of captivity animals in cages and so forth. So this musang is so tame. Now, I let him out in the laboratory. He'd run around in the laboratory, you know. He's well behaved, you know. And what happens, you know, when Harrison asked me, well, you kept this musang for nearly about 6-7 years, and he's very big now. It's high time you write a paper on it. That was my first paper. You know, my first paper was turned down by Professor Harrison for 18 times.
18 times?
Yes. Every time I write, rewrite. And I can appreciate that.
I mean, he molded.
Yes.
I mean, 301 papers came after that, so it has to be something.
I think zoology today, very unfortunate with the latest technology. Zoology is excellent. People like zoology very much, you know. And in Malaysia in particular, you know, to be a zoologist, you have to sacrifice yourself. If you want to be a zoologist, forget about earning money. You have to be interested and go on. Because, you know, there's not much avenue of jobs that you can get. Now, with the latest technology that comes up on DNA and this sort of thing, now people go into that field. You know why people like to go to that field? It is a very important field and is an excellent tool in whatever subjects that you think of. And it's a tool, you know, there's no need for you to go to the forest, you know, and hack yourself up to know about animals.
Like the good old days.
Yeah, the good old days. You know. And then you end up with most of the university graduates today, you know, they prefer to work with a job because it's a lab job.
So I guess technology today has kind of improve and enhance, you know, research, but in a way, taking away the excitement and the wildlife aspect.
You said it very rightly.
Of
I would
zoology.
Not be able to interpret how you interpret it.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I see it.
That's
and
right.
This kind of makes sense, right?
Exactly. You interpret very rightly.
So when you work a lot with young people now and young scientists, would you say that this thing hinders them from becoming great zoologists?
You see, after when I retired from WHO, I came back in 1957. And in 1958, I started with a director of the wildlife department. You know, we are very good friends. And then he told me, "Lim, can you come help me out? You know, but I have no money to give you." I thought money is immaterial for that part of time because I got a pension. My pension, though, at that time is small, but it keep me alive, you know. But more important in my life, I felt that I was given every opportunity to be what I am today. And it is only fair now that I should give it back. And since 1947, up to now, I've been doing a lot of voluntary work for Wildlife Department, for all the universities, you know, everybody, you know. Because I think I have to give back.
So where does the future lie? Where does the future of our zoologists or zoology in Malaysia, where does it lie?
I think the future is still good, you know, it's still good. I think people are beginning to realize, you know, that the importance of conservation. And when you are thinking about conservation and so forth, you need people. And you need people with a certain amount of technical knowledge. And here, the zoologists come in. You know, one of the things that I profess, you know, that very unfortunately, I don't think people will listen to me. You know. One day, someone asked me, you know, this outing, asked me, you know, what do you think, you know, how biology study can progress and so forth. You know. When you talk about biology studies, a lot of people just shy away from biology. You say, how could it be done? You know, it brings me back to the days when I was in pre-bodies in school, where natural history was studied not only in the class, but also in the field.
Yeah.
Which is very, very common in Western countries.
Yeah.
You know, you go to any Western countries, you find a natural history study, you study outside the field. The teacher will take them out, you know, to the garden and so forth, and they will show them all the animal, all the grass and lalang, everything, you know. And then they ask them to pick back something, whatever snail they collected, take it back to the lab and take it back to the class. And then from the class, they teach them all these sort of things. And I thought, you know, that zoologists are very hard to get a job. Very, very hard to get a job. You know, the moment you mentioned you are a zoologist, you know, it's so hard to get a job because there's no avenue of employment here. So what happened was, I thought that might be a very good idea. We have to think very seriously now that all schools should continue to revive natural history study.
That outdoor aspect, yeah.
And then the schools should employ zoologists.
To teach.
Yeah,
seems like a solid plan.
No. Then people will be, a lot of youngsters who are interested in zoology. Why not? The moment I come out, I can get a get a job. I think this is very essential.
That was Dr. Lim Bu Liat, a renowned zoologist and one of the pioneers of zoology in Malaysia. If you'd like to check out the full interview, do head over to our website www.bfm.my/ILoveKL. And that brings to a close our show for this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, do not forget you can tweet us. We are at BFM Radio. Also, do get updates on our latest podcast by downloading our app via Google Play and the App Store. I have been Daryl Ong, signing off our mid-year roundup. Have a great second half of the year and join us again next week right here on I Love KL, the show that brings you closer to the people and places of our capital city. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn. Ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn. Tell people to stay off the lawn. Compare it to your neighbor's lawn. And complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.